Okay, so this meeting is a, I mean, you know, I'm going to present for about half an hour probably on Zionism and the current situation, and then we'll follow up with as discussion, much discussion as people want, if that's all right. Yeah. Okay. So what we're now witnessing is the brutal forced evacuation of eastern central Rafah, which is, you know, the southernmost city in the Gaza Strip, adjoining Egypt, to a tiny coastal enclave. And this is going to be another, even more brutal massacre than those that have taken place previously further north, because the population now has nowhere to really flee to. But so far, Israel has not been able to order them to leave Gaza for Sinai in Egypt. And I think that's significant and a product of the Zionists being outmaneuvered by Hamas, who jointly put together a plan to end the Israeli massacre with Qatar and Egypt, which had implicit US support, you could argue, because both Qatar and Egypt are strong US allies. Although slightly contradicting that, I've just heard that Egypt has joined the ICJ genocide case against Israel, which has certainly not got the support of the United States. So I think it's a bit more complex than that. But anyway, this plan to end the slaughter was rejected by Israel, because it would have been a defeat for them. You know, it's very clear that in this situation, a permanent ceasefire means a defeat for Israel. And the US and Israel's other imperialist allies know that very well, that a permanent ceasefire means an Israeli defeat. And that's why the demand for it is like trying to get blood out of a stone, you know. But Israel is now overextended, both militarily and politically, and under enormous pressure. And you could say that Rafah is the last fig leaf that disguises the fact that Israel is being defeated, because they can again kill many civilians, but they've got no chance to wipe out Hamas. And they'll take casualties here also. It's inevitable. You know, they attempted to divert attention from this process of defeat by aggression against Iran. But that diversionary attempt has failed, and they also were given something of a defeat by Iran, even though a symbolic defeat. So now we're back at the sharp edge of the genocide again. They were resuming demands for evacuations in Gaza City yesterday, dropping leaflets telling people to flee so that they could deal with Hamas. But isn't there something of a deja vu about that? Because they're supposed to have won that months ago, you know. Gaza City was pulverized months ago, but they haven't defeated Hamas in Gaza City. They wouldn't be doing this otherwise, you know. So the Biden administration is desperately trying to reconcile the irreconcilable. They're desperate for this carnage to end, but not because of any humanitarian motive, but because it's radicalizing their population and upsetting Biden's election campaign. That's the reason. It's nothing to do with any humanitarian motion. And it should be very clear now that in the 7 months of wanton slaughter that have gone on since the 7th of October, they've got no qualms about the Israelis massacring Palestinian civilians, as long as they thought it might win them something. But now it's clear that Israel is not going to defeat, and let alone eliminate, Hamas. They're bloodthirsty, barbaric, racist army, the most powerful, most cowardly and immoral army in the world, can butcher tens of thousands, maybe even hundreds of thousands of civilians in the most rabid slaughter since Rwanda in 1994, but they cannot defeat the Palestinian resistance. And what's happening instead is that the young population of the West is being radicalized from being exposed to radicalized from being exposed to this butchery and genocide. The US ruling class is trying to ban TikTok because it's kept American youth he's another, it's radicalizing American youth, you know. And it's keeping people, keeping them informed about the crimes that Israel is carrying out in Gaza. And indeed the accelerating repression in the West Bank as well. But it's too late. The cat's out of the bag already. Once people see what Israel is doing, they cannot unsee it. The Zionists complain of youth being radicalized by their crimes and ridiculously compare the results of their own work with 1930s anti-Semitism, which is totally insulting to the most basic intelligence, since Zionist barbarism itself is similar to Nazi barbarism. So all over the US, students are organizing protest camps in hundreds of universities and colleges. And pitch battles are taking place with violent cops acting under orders from Zionist and white supremacist politicians the length and breadth of imperialist North America. You know, from Columbia University in New York to UCLA on the West Coast, from Texas to Canada. There are Gaza protesting encampments in Harvard and Yale, which are the US's most elite universities. They all demand divestments of university assets from Israeli and Zionist companies and an end to the frequent military academic collaboration that regularly goes on. And now this has spread to Europe. In France and Germany, there have also been pitched battles between students and the police. Also in Sweden yesterday, I noticed something similar happened around the Eurovision Song Contest, also involving students in some aspects of this, I believe. In Spain, on the other hand, 76 universities have acted collectively to suspend ties with implicit with supposedly complicit, well, I'm sure they are complicit, Israeli universities via something called the Conference of University Rectors. And in Britain, student protests and encampments are spreading throughout the country. Likewise, protests are underway at Oxbridge universities, among other places. And Rishi Sunak is complaining about it and trying to incite repression here also. So you've got Oxford and Cambridge, you've got the Sorbonne, you've got Harvard and Yale, as well as less salubrious universities heavily involved. It's actually destabilizing the bourgeoisie's most, you know, elite institutions, the places where their most treasured youth are actually educated. And, student protests are still continuing throughout the imperialist world and spreading, even though it's being, you know, even though they're being repressed quite savagely. Young people are prepared to risk their futures because they're less and less convinced that they have a future in a society dominated by genocidal politicians as well as corporate climate deniers. And this is evidently a global student movement. It's been compared to the student movements around the Vietnam War. I think it may actually prove even more significant than that. But I think it's also misleading and misreading the situation to see it as simply a student protest movement. It's certainly a movement of the intelligentsia that prefigures what society itself is thinking in its depths. And that's actually confirmed by many public opinion polls in the advanced countries. Israel's allies, its sponsors, its lackeys even, wear clear majorities actually strongly disapprove of Israel's genocidal onslaught and consider it to be a genocide. To continue, the decision in January of the International Court of Justice, I think, to state publicly that there's a plausible prima facie case to accuse Israel of genocide was actually a reflection of the same popular pressure months before the student movements took off. You know, this is a very bourgeois institution. It's designed from the start as a kind of safety switch for imperialism so it can amnesty itself, it can indict its opponents and excuse its allies. And you know, the provisional measures that were ordered by the ICJ were something of a joke, actually. They responded to South Africa's indictment by calling on Israel to stop what they're doing and protect the civilian population that they'd like to dispose of. And there's a fat chance of that, isn't there? Because if they're remotely inclined to do any of that, this issue would not exist in the first place, you know. So is the international, so the International Criminal Court as well. They do it. They're similar, very bourgeois institution, but now threatening to indict Netanyahu and Gallon and others in the Israeli regime. Their usual activity is in trying to indict the West's opponents, like Putin or Milosevic or various black African leaders. They've not actually yet indicted Netanyahu, and they may back off under pressure. And that's shown by the letter of 10 Republican senators threatening the ICC with military sanctions and sanctions against their families if they do indict Netanyahu and Gallon, etc. The fact that these bodies actually feel compelled to say anything remotely in the right ballpark is a reflection of mass sentiment, nothing more, Not just the overwhelming sentiment in the global south, over which South Africa has made the running politically. And very strongly in terms of perceived morality, which should not be dismissed. But in terms of the knowledge that the ruling class in general in the West have about the huge damage that's being done to their moral authority over the masses at home. Mass student protests historically are often the harbinger of more convulsive social and political movements. And I could go through quite a long list, from the role of ferment among students and intelligentsia in influencing the masses and leading to the growth of a mass socialist and communist movement in Russia in the late 19th century and the early 20th century, And there's a huge role played by students in assembling the intellectual forces for anti-colonial and anti-imperialist movements throughout the world, particularly after the First World War and again after the Second World War, And in a more recent time frame, there is actually the role of the mass student movement in France in the late 60s, the student radicals who fought the CRS, which is the military riot police in Paris and in other parts of France during the 1968 upheavals, is a mixture of homegrown social discontent, anti-imperialist radicalism was again centered mainly on the Vietnam War, which of course France was the original belligerent against the Vietnamese people before the Americans were. This student movement managed to coalesce with a mass movement of working class discontent. And it burst out in a huge outburst, a general strike that forced Charles de Gaulle to flee the country. Until the dependable forces, of the French Communist Party were able to restore order and get the workers back to work, But that took some doing and they had the authority to do it. No one else had, And that activity led to the discredit of the very reformist Communist Party at that time and the growth of quite large organisations of the French far left in the 1970s, And that's not the subject of this forum, really. We're actually in very different circumstances today. What we're really faced with is understanding where we are now and what to fight for. But it's equally possible today that major working class movements akin to May 68, with revolutionary implications, can emerge from this crisis. It's possible, and I think it's likely. And we must be alert to and participate in them to the best of our ability when that happens as communists. We're in a very different situation now than we were in the 60s, The US really achieved full world hegemony after the destruction of the USSR, and Zionist power in the world was massively enhanced through its factions within the US and European imperialist ruling classes. As long as the USSR existed, what people tended to call the bipolar world, Zionist power was somewhat overshadowed by the need for the US to concentrate on its own offensive against the USSR and the other workers' states. But when the USSR collapsed, we had this situation of what seemed to be a unipolar world where the US's world hegemony appeared to be unchallenged. And we had that situation beginning in the late 90s, in the 90s anyway, when Israel appeared to be able to get the United States to fight its wars for it. You know, there was an element about that even in the 1991 Iraq war, because Israel had a definite interest in cutting Iraq down to size. And it showed it even earlier than that when it bombed the Iraqi reactor in 1981. But there's some very suspicious stuff about the manner in which Hussein was actually lured into Iraq by the US ambassador, April Glaspie, who basically invited him to invade, you know. It was suspicious to say the least. It was a trap. It was deliberate. The question of the motives is open to question, but Iraq had previously and very conspicuously been the US ally against Iran. So it's rather incongruous, I think, the way that happened. But I think the connection with Zionism has something to do with it. But it's very, very clear that in the second Iraq war in 2003 that the successful US and UK invasion and then the failed occupation of Iraq, it had Zionism and neocons written all over it. It's always been Israeli policy to find ways to prevent any successful regional power from emerging that could challenge their right, so-called right, to dispossess the Palestinians. And that drove all their wars. But finding a sympathetic hegemon to wage war for them was not quite so simple. It proved not so simple in 1956, when the US and the USSR temporarily united against Britain and France to put them back in their box, you know. And they had more luck in 1967, still with tacit French support, actually. Their armaments were mainly French. But they seemed to be acting alone, and they defeated Nasser and Assad and the King of Jordan. But they had an ambiguous relationship with the US at that point, and that was shown by the attack on the USS Liberty when an American ship got in their way during the Six-Day War. They blew it out of the water, didn't they? You know. But on the other hand, in 1973, they were threatened with the reversal of 1967 by forces that were seen, certainly by the Nixon administration, as Soviet allied. Nixon actually saw Israel for the first time as a strategic US ally, and he put US forces on alert to stop them being defeated, basically. And that was a pretty close shave with nuclear war, you know. Whether it was quite as severe as the Cuban Missile Crisis, I'm not sure. But from the 1990s until the mid-20-teens, I think, were the heyday of Zionism, coincided with this thing about the unipolar world, where the US appeared to be the dominant world power. In many ways it was, and you know, the world appeared to be Israel's oyster, and the US was quite prepared to fight its wars for them. But I think those days are really over, you know, because they're over because the unipolar world is ending, you know. One of the things that really began to show this was what happened with the Arab Spring, which was really a very incoherent and inchoate upsurge of democratic struggles in the Arab world that was easily exploited by imperialism. They had very little political consciousness. And it also showed the beginning of the end for US hegemony because of what the destruction of Libya, to start with, followed the pattern of Iraq and was very similar, you know. But then you had the failure in Syria, and that was simply because Russia reasserted its power for the first time since the collapse of the Soviet Union against the US, and against the Zionists and against the neocons, and refused to allow them to destroy Syria, which would have been a major triumph for the Zionists if they had succeeded. We do know the evidence exists that Israel gave material help and medical help to the mercenary jihadists in this war. The destruction of the Assads was always a key priority of Zionism. and no cyanide deal has been possible over Golan. No cyanide type deal has been possible over Golan since 1967 for that very reason, you know, because they want to destroy the Assad, who are always seen as a prime enemy of Zionism. And that's a key reason why the struggle against Zionism and the struggle against the NATO war in Ukraine have proved to be interdependent. It's the decline of US imperialism, US hegemony, that's leading to the decline of Zionism also. If you look at what's going on in Ukraine, there is ideological overlap between the two conflicts, between the Ukrainian proxy of the US and Israel. Zelensky is actually a Zionist who was carefully groomed by the Americans to camouflage the Nazi character of the Maidan regime in Ukraine after 2014. And Zelensky very clearly expressed his solidarity with Israel after the 7th of October. And then there's the Azov Brigade, you know, the famous Nazi battalion in Ukraine, you know, who founded it? Who was its founding funder? It was a guy called Ihor Kolomoisky, who is an Israeli-Ukrainian oligarch. And he stumped up the funds to found this Nazi battalion in Ukraine, whose original symbol was the wolf sound. He wasn't the leader of it. He wasn't the militia leader, but he was the man who funded it. Its original symbol was the wolf sangle, which is the symbol of the Das Reich division of the SS that committed atrocities in occupied France, among other places. And this confluence of Nazism and Zionism has a long history, and it goes back to the 1930s and then World War II. Zionists collaborated with the Nazis in order to gain approval for their state project in Palestine. And Tony Greenstein, who I've got many disagreements with on Zionism, or have had many disagreements with on Zionism and anti-Semitism, has written a worthwhile and serious book on this called Zionism and the Holocaust. It's actually reviewed on our website, and I recommend the book, and I recommend our review as well, which I think puts it in some context. So what is behind Zionism's apparent strength? And I would argue that the secret of Zionism's power has been that part of the Israeli ruling class lives outside Israel's borders, you know, in the United States, in Western Europe, and it's organized as an imperialist faction that's primarily loyal to Israel. Israel effectively has an extraterritorial citizenship law that makes that possible. Which means that Israel, this both Israel and this formation which bolsters it, is a composite, an imperialist composite formation, and the existence of this phenomena makes Israel an imperialist power of at least medium strength. You know, I think if this external faction or body or, you know, bourgeois layer did not exist, Israel would be quite a minor imperialist country like Denmark or somewhere like that, you know. But it's much more powerful than that. The origins of this phenomena is it came from the history of the Jews, from the top-heavy social structure of the mainly Ashkenazi Jewish population in Europe in medieval times. As a people class, as Abram Lien called it in his famous work, The Jewish Question, A Marxist Interpretation. And that trading class became obsolete under late feudalism. But the Jewish population, even though it was no longer quite in that political, in that social niche anymore, it was marked by it. It under late feudalism became an obsolete class whose remnants were particularly subjected to religious persecution, you know. But they were emancipated by the bourgeois revolutions, particularly after the French Revolution, but also to a degree in Britain, actually, under Cromwell. And under capitalism, that population was naturally, because of its history as a class, the population was more intellectual and more bourgeois, but both at the same time, actually, than the mainstream populations that did not have that class legacy and that class history, you know. So Jews were actually disproportionately intellectuals who, having experience of persecution, played an important and progressive role in democratic, socialist and working class movements. But there's another layer of Jews that was disproportionately successful in capitalist business and for related reasons, you know. And as we know, as we should reason, disproportionate capitalist property gives disproportionate social power in a capitalist society where the chief social power is the bourgeoisie. And in my view, the Jewish question is a legacy of a European pre-capitalist phenomena involving this trading and middleman class that spilled over into the epoch of progressive capitalism. And then capitalism ceased to be progressive and became imperialist in the late 19th century, you know. And the interaction of this phenomena with imperialism gave rise to two complementary imperialist movements, which were respectively racial anti-Semitism, was a reaction against this phenomena, and Zionism, which was a movement of this section of the bourgeoisie, both of which proved to be ultimately genocidal, because both of them logically sought to dispose of whole populations that were unwanted in their own respective imperialist projects. And we saw the genocidal proclivities of racial anti-Semitism against the Jews themselves, played out during the Second World War as Germany lost its own bid for world imperialist hegemony. And now, as US imperialism, which is in some ways acts as Zionism's host, is in the process of losing its world hegemony, we're seeing Zionism's genocidal proclivities played out as the Palestinian Arab population of what claims to be Israel is equally unwanted by Israel. And, you know, that Arab population is still the majority in historic Palestine. And indeed, if the right to return were of those who were driven out since 1948 were won, they'd actually be a substantial majority. The Israeli rulers want that demographic threat eliminated. Fortunately, they're losing. But it's not really clear just how destructive they're prepared to be if they face defeat, as I think they do, you know. The question is, will they commit suicide, as a very, very well-known Israeli musician asked recently, will they commit suicide, as in Masada, which was the incident where a Zionist fortress committed suicide rather than surrender to the Romans, or will they try to destroy humanity as they fall? What's called the Samson option, where they bring the whole ceiling down on everybody, you know. And I think it's an open question. You know, there are some fairly apocalyptic possibilities if Israel loses. But what can we do? You know, it has to be defeated because it's a genocidal project. And our job is to defend the oppressed. I'll leave it there. Thank you, comrades. Who wants to speak?
Ian, can I speak?
You certainly can.
I don't have much to add, you know, because you went round very well and even much deeper than even myself, I understand. So, all praise to this evaluation, which is very important and which ends now with the situation we are in. I see that Mark Irwin says, yeah, for all the talk of this hegemony, whatever, it's still a huge war machine, he says. I think big, huge contradictions have sort of crystallized around this question, the question of the Jews. I see that, if you look somewhere on the internet, they say that, it is not, Zionism is not the same thing as colonization. And there is quite an argumentation about this. I think that deserves, of course it deserves, calling it out, but as well it deserves an analysis because it's based on the lie that Jewish people have a historic connection with the land of Israel, what they call the land of Israel, and that goes back millions or thousands of years. That deserves a little bit of history, which is beyond what I can do, but nevertheless I think it will be done. So that to show that what is happening now is one of the last gasps of the ambition to continue a system which is based on the exploitation, on the expropriation and the pillage of other countries. Because in the end, it's not just Zionism, which is like this, it is, of course, like you said, it's the capitalist system, which has given a framework for Zionism to have an immensely superior force to that which it deserves from its own material existence. You can see Israel having immensely more military clout than is justified by its capacity to produce or to transform the economy. They haven't got the economy for the power which they are projecting. And it is the US and NATO that are lending this to it. So the problem, of course, is the system which is based on colonization in order to exist, to derive capital. So I think at some stage this matter needs to be linked with capital, the accumulation of capital, to retake from what you said, Ian, from the origins of the Jewish were populations which were engaged in financial, and then they did that came from the history that you explained. Mm-hmm. And now it has acquired in this stage of the higher globalization of capitalism, it has acquired a global reach, and like you have shown, it has an impact all over the world. Just to finish, I think that when we can, we should look into what is colonization, why is it necessary? It is inherent to exploitation. It's inherent. It starts with the exploitation of labor, but as it becomes a system, it becomes the exploitation of the world, particularly what they call the global south, for example, at the moment. And so the fact it is in such a bad state in that part of the world that the act of colonization is denounced. And this, the slogan, de-decolonize, that has been adopted by the students and pro-Palestinians, they say all sorts of slogans, but one of them is de-decolonize, which I think is supremely important because it's linking now this struggle, the struggle of the students and thousands, probably millions of people are involved in supporting Gaza, but that is remaining at the moment at a place where the trade unions do not need to come. And we have to arrange, I think, in due course, to attract the attention of the trade unions that they are keeping away from this. Because in fact, it's questioning who is making the bombs, who is manufacturing the arms, and then it's giving to BDS a new role. And so I look forward now to when we can discuss that again. Jonathan wants to speak.
Yeah,
sorry, I'm muted. John, yes, John. Sorry.
Yeah. No, just briefly, I wanted a question, you know, a question answered. This thing doing the rounds in the bourgeois media that Netanyahu is just keeping the war going to save his own skin. And, that's what a large part of this war is about. You know, I'd just like to know, you know, what an answer to that would look like. You know, that, you know, that it isn't just some individuals, you know, trying to keep the war going and for his own interests and that sort of thing.
Sure. Yeah. Anybody else want to speak? I will come back on that, because I think Netanyahu doesn't actually represent just Netanyahu. He represents a whole strand of Israeli society, the main party of the ruling class, actually, you know. Which, you know, Likud is the main party of the Israeli ruling class. It's evolved into that position over a long period. Because in the earlier period of Zionism, the Labour Zionists were dominant. But since the late 70s, it's turned the other way. And I think that's the logic of Zionism, isn't it? The left fringe of Zionism was always superfluous. Was always doomed to become superfluous because it is a genocidal project in its logic, and the socialist pretensions at some point had to be thrown overboard, and they would be, you know. So, you know, obviously there are forces to his right. He's actually leaned on the extremist settler movements and the people like Ben Gavir and Smotrich and whatever, you know, but I think they are the dominant trend, and if they suffer a defeat, it's a crippling blow to the Israeli ruling class and the Israeli state. So I don't think it's just Netanyahu. I mean, Netanyahu has personal interests in staving off a possible corruption trial and being thrown into jail, possibly, you know. Although whether that will actually happen, I'm not sure. But I don't think it's a personal question. I think it's about the coherence of the Israeli state, and I think that's why it's so serious. The Hamas attack on the 7th of October, well, I mean, it obviously involves civilian casualties, etc., but I don't think we, you know, that was not the conscious result of the Hamas strategy, you know. The strategy was to kidnap and exchange people, and to strike a major military blow at the confidence of Israel. And it succeeded enormously, actually. And that's why the genocidal consequence is so severe, you know, because it was effective, in my opinion, you know. And Israel, yeah, many of the people who were killed on the 7th of October were killed by Israel in its desperation to stave it off, you know, the Hannibal Directive, I think it is, or whatever, you know. They killed a hell of a lot of their own people. And even those who were killed by Palestinians were not necessarily killed by Hamas. Because Scott Ritter said, the one mistake they did make is they didn't leave a rear guard to stop unruly elements from breaking through afterwards and exploiting the situation, you know. But I don't think Hamas Qaeda actually set out to massacre anybody. They certainly set out to capture people, though, you know, which, of course, is a crime according to some renditions of international law. But from the point of view of the proletariat, it's not necessarily a crime to take hostages, actually. The Paris Commune took hostages, by the way, you know, at the end, and rightly so, because they were trying to stave off a massacre. And I think it's legitimate in some situations to do that, personally. But anyway, that's my penneth on this.
I'll need to put my hand up, won't I?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Okay, two or three things. One is, I think, thanks to the last sort of 7 or 8 months of the Gaza genocide, an awful lot more people have been re-educated about the difference between Zionism and Judaism. Zionism is, you know, Zionists, Christian Zionists or evangelical Zionists, however you want to describe them, are more numerous than, you know, I wouldn't even call them necessarily Jewish Zionists, but certainly Jewish and the Israeli Zionists. I don't think enough people, you know, we have a media which is very busily trying to use the anti-Semitism slur But the protest people have been very astute in making sure that they identify that there are many Jews in the protest, that this is not a religious thing. But what I do think we have is a situation where it is a war against certain religions. It's a divisive thing. And Ukraine and Israel share a lot in common with that because, you know, Ukraine has systematically attacked both the Ukrainian Orthodox Church and the Russian Orthodox Church and installed what, for want of a better word, are just pagan insults. I think for me, the underlying thing about it is one, Israel was set up in 1948, the same time as white South Africa, and both share in common a supremacist ideology, which was supposed to keep both the gold and diamond market in South Africa and the control of the fossil fuel markets as was in what's now, if you like, West Asia or the Middle East. And two, this business of systematically Zionists and this whole US hegemony, or if you like, CIA and MI6 dominated hegemony, has gone after what are established multicultural, multi-ethnic, tolerant societies. Societies like Iraq and Iran, like Syria in particular, and others where all of the religions live together. They had this idea that they would, I think it, what was it, that put the Christians in Lebanon? And the, you know, the whole support of the Muslim Brotherhood by Israel in order to keep pushing extremists, people who wanted to set up their own promised land. It wasn't just about Israel and its history of its identification with Israel. You've got the support for the Kurds in, you know, they were going to get a piece of Syria, or and that was supported by Turkey because they don't want, you know, they want to solve their Kurdish problem. It's the Uyghur genocide that hasn't happened, but the Americans are still pushing the idea that they would like to sit on, you know, one of the most, if you like, valuable pieces of land. It's the same with what's going on in, isn't it, Turkmenistan, which they recruited people to do the Crocus City Hall massacre. It's been a consistent, shall we say, policy of the, you know, the deep state, as I think a lot of people call it, to fund extremist groups who will destabilize economies and regimes which are otherwise successful and would offer an alternative to what's basically a increasingly predatory capitalist system in the West that's no longer being tolerated. What I thought was really good was the fact that countries like Pakistan have pushed back against Israel. You know, that the Israeli spokesman at the UN doing his little gaslighting party trick with shredding the UN charter are being ignored by the global rest of the world. And they are continuing to expose, you know, the atrocities that are happening now and not falling for the gaslighting that's going on at the moment. But the biggest thing at the moment is Israel's losing. Ukraine is losing. And it seems to me that history tells us that the two things which are united for a revolution to be effective are, one, the students that you talked about, but two, losing a war.
Mm-hmm.
Because it brings down it questions the ruling elite's management of both, you know, foreign and military matters, which they have always insisted on that they are the only people who are fit to be in charge, and they are failing badly at both. But I don't know what anyone else feels. Max?
I know. Who else wants to speak?
Max Owen. I hear no socialist.
I think
Yeah. Oh, right.
Yeah, come on.
Hello.
Well, yeah. Actually, that's what I was referring to. My understanding of the military in America is that it tends to be, it's not as class bound as here, but I can tell you that the English or the British are not as bad as the French, but military hierarchy and promotion within the ranks is very class ridden. Whereas I think it's more about a history of family connections with the military. But
I don't know.
The downfall of the military in America at the moment is they're being appointed for their political views and not for their competence.
Well, I don't
know. Isn't that a complaint about the likes of Lloyd Austin?
I don't know that much. I know that I don't know the relative. I'm not a military family person, but from what I've seen, people I've known, and my Marxist viewpoint, with the relative French, UK, United States, from what I've met socialists who were in the military, it's very class-based. What forms that takes with families and scratching backs, it's tricky, though, because sometimes the soldiers get promoted, it's kind of like capitalism itself. There's some room for upward mobility, but it's mostly, it's mostly class-based. I mean, these are capitalist armies. This is basic Marxism 101. Okay, well, the things we're talking about. But anyway, somebody asked me to speak before, and I was commenting about how, as a person who's sort of a scholar, I'm kind of like trying to figure it out. Like, it's clear that these students are protesting. There's a lot of talk because of the Ukraine war in the last few years and the increased censorship. It shows how desperate they are, but it doesn't mean they're going to lose just because they're showing how bad they are and people are protesting. That still doesn't make a revolution. I'm not trying to be negative. It's just I'm getting these sentiments, not just from comrades here, but from people like Scott Ritter and in the United States. Because there's no journalism and you have to go to Jimmy Dore and all these people. But they're kind of like, some of these people are sort of waking up themselves, and none of them are really Trotskyists like we are. So it's kind of like, well, but they're useful in terms of hard news and some basic principles, like Ritter, very much so, as I think we all have learned. But at the same time, he thinks Stalin was a great guy. So there's these contradictions. So I don't get too excited about, oh, they're going to lose because they're bad. If we don't have some kind of, this is the tricky part, because military is important. And I kind of feel like I'm not the best revolutionary because I don't have connections to that. But, the working class is who does the most of the fighting and dying in all these things. Well, not in Israel. Obviously, it's a perversion. It's like Ritter is saying, like, they don't even have, like, the decency of regular warfare, which is a horrible thing. But this is, like, even worse. The levels of depravity are just amazing. So we all can relate to that. But I don't know. It's hard for me to get all excited, about, like, oh, great things are going to – all this talk of multipolarity, it's kind of like, well, maybe, but it still might take, another 100 years before the world actually progresses toward, some kind of socialist ideal. And, I think we're on the brink of a nuclear war right now. So it's kind of like touch and go. But, none of us have a crystal ball. I hope you see what I'm saying. I'm not poo-pooing everything. I'm just saying I don't have that much hope. And I hear these things from other parts of the left that aren't really, don't understand Trotsky's principles. I'll stop there. No.
Sure.
I agree with a lot of what you're saying. But
I'm not that disciplined.
Revolution
speaker.
Will be,
yeah.
It'll be in each country what the people choose, not necessarily what Trotsky would have advised or necessarily what we think things ought to be. I think, obviously most of us here in Britain, it's about desperately wanting something that is not.
Yeah, well, of course.
Necessarily the same as what is around in other countries.
Okay, let me just say, I could have easily said De Leon because that's my real base in my personal life. So I said Trotsky's because I think I'm in a group of Trotsky's here. I was using that loosely. I was using that. In other words, we have to have some kind of real concrete fighting force to take power, to take power in any situation. So it's, you know, with all this tendencies and BRICS and unipolar, multipolar world, it's still a capital. Even it's like these levels, you know, but I think a lot of these people think, well, the world would be better if we just balance the power. You know, there's a lot of leftists who still have a lot of faith in bourgeois democracy because they don't really think of it as bourgeois democracy. Is kind of what I'm saying. You know what I mean? The consciousness. Mm. They can be revolted by what's going on in Gaza, et cetera, but they're still not, you know, we still have the struggle of the working class. So that's why when I relate to, when I try to study the Middle East and stuff, I've never been there. I don't know. I just read about it. I know it was a bad thing, you know. But I don't know, like, who's – there's probably some Palestinian capitalist there exploiting some – you know, where's the class line? It's, you know, it's not just an imperialist thing. There's a lot going on. Obviously, what I heard somewhere was that a lot of the Palestinians in like, Gaza used to be working class that the mostly – Jewish and some capitalists needed, and now they no longer need them, which is a similar phenomenon that's happening around the world with technology. I heard that somewhere. I think that might be what I'm trying to figure out instead of just talking about. But the subject of this is Israel going to lose? And I really want to define what you mean by lose. Like, are they going to lose their country? I don't think so, because they get the biggest imperialist power. You know, it's kind of saying, is Hitler going to lose in 1940? Well, he might lose someday, but, you know, and they don't even have, you know, the opposition. Well, I don't know. I don't want to go on and on, but you see what I'm thinking about it. Sure. But I have my principles. But I can see a lot of you, like Ian, you know a lot more details of history. Like, you mentioned the thing about the liberty. I've heard about that, but I don't really understand it. Mm-hmm. But I wonder why. Yeah, I wonder why we support Israel so much. There must be some geostrategic reason, and a lot of people aren't really talking about that either. You know, if it wasn't for the U.S., you know, just raw power and military machine, you know, they want to control the world. So if Israel is the way to do it, that's one way to do it in that area. But you know, the same thing in Russia.
Yeah.
And Ukraine. Mark,
Mark. No, actually, Max has just asked the question I was going to ask. I mean, how do you define Israel losing? I mean, clearly their PR tactics are the worst in probably human history. Totally cack-handed and Neanderthal, and they're so easy to explode. But in material terms, I'm not sure where it's going to come from when they have the amount of support they have from the US.
Well,
I mean, would the US have to be brought down in some way for that to happen or not, would you say? Thanks.
Just on this, I mean, I think that failing to suppress Hamas, which is their war aim, their declared war aim is to suppress Hamas, to root it out of the Gaza Strip, and to colonize the Gaza Strip, basically. If they fail to do that, they've lost. You know, and I think that they're on the verge of failure in that war aim. And there is a big problem here, because if you look at what's happened to Israel since the 7th of October, first of all, large areas of Israel are now evacuated of the civilian population. Not just the area around the Gaza Strip in the Negev area and that area in the south, but also the area in the north near Lebanon has had to be evacuated of most of the civilian population. They are settlers, effectively, because they're in danger if a war breaks out of being pulverized by missiles from Lebanon and from Syria, you know, from Hezbollah, in other words, which is very heavily armed. So big chunks of Israel are now sort of not really Israel. They're in a sort of limbo, aren't they? You know. And the other thing that's happening is a large number of Israeli Jews are leaving Israel, right? As I think George Galloway pointed out, it's very difficult to get a ticket out because it's oversubscribed. People are leaving. People who've got dual nationality in European countries, even ones that were in, you know, like Poland, that were the centres of the Holocaust and whatever, are leaving Israel in large numbers. Because they don't think it's safe to live there anymore. They think it's unviable. And, of course, the more leave, the more the relationship of forces, of demographic forces, between the Jews and the Arabs tilts more in favour of the Arabs, despite all the killings that go on that have been happening in the Gaza Strip and the other repression. It just makes Israel more and more unviable as a Jewish state. And it makes the project of liberation, which is the embodied in the slogan "From the River to the Sea," right? What that means is a single democratic state where all have equal rights. It makes that more and more feasible, actually. So I think that you could actually see an Israelis being forced to concede that they can't suppress Hamas would be a massive symbolic blow to the prestige of the ruling class. And I think it would destabilize it. And the United States has been forced to back off. You know, they've backed off from, you know, I mean, originally they were threatening war against all sorts of people, against Hezbollah, at, you know, right at the beginning after after the 7th of October. They were threatening Hezbollah that if Hezbollah dared to intervene, we will do this, we will do that. We have an aircraft carrier within, what was it called? I can't remember the name. Named after Gerald Ford, the worst president. The most cack-handed president in American history, apart from Trump. You know, the one who couldn't walk and chew gum at the same time, allegedly. You know. But, I mean, they've got that aircraft carrier was withdrawn a few weeks later because it was not it was not politic to have it there. It was not going well. And it was more vulnerable, you know, the whole idea of an American intervention became more and more unviable, you know. So, you know, I think Israel is not really an asset for the United States. It's a peculiar historically evolved problem that they have to deal with because of the power of Israel in the United States, to quote a book on the subject, you know, I can't remember the author, but a very well known book.
The Israeli lobby?
Yeah, it's about the Israel lobby, basically. Yeah. The power of that faction of the American ruling class, which is loyal to Israel. It's a peculiar contradiction in imperialism that's come to the fore in the last two or three decades. You know, it's become particularly notorious. The USS Liberty, I think somebody asked about the USS Liberty, it was Max. The USS Liberty was an American ship. It was a spy ship. It was monitoring the Israelis massacring Egyptian prisoners of war at the end of the Six-Day War. And they basically thought, well, they basically blew it out of the water because it was in their way and it was not doing what they wanted it to do. And it's been a long running sore in American politics under the surface because everybody, you know, the whole story has been suppressed. And people who've tried to raise it are routinely accused of anti-Semitism. And, you know, even ex-military people who were wounded on the Liberty have been accused of anti-Semitism for raising this issue, you know. So it's a long-running military secret scandal, whatever, you know. If you read out some of Alison Weir's stuff, If Americans Knew, it's very informative about this. You know, you search for If Americans Knew, which is a particularly useful website run by a lady called Alison Weir. You know, there's a lot of material under the covers, you know, under the surface that can be weeded out and studied, you know. Just on the question of Jews and is Zionism Jewish? And the answer is yes and no, because it couldn't possibly exist if it were not Jewish in some sense, because it's a movement for a Jewish state. You know, you can have as many Christian Zionists as you like. And that is a peculiar facet of Christian theology is, has got very strange attitudes towards Jews, both anti-Semitic and philo-Semitic. There's some sections of Christians who are very, very, you know, indulgent of the Jews, and there are other sections that hate their guts, you know, and it flip-flops all over the place. But I think this section, this aspect of Christian theology is just a peculiarity of Christianity, and it goes back centuries, you know, millennia, you know. But such things do exist, you know, theological obsessions and contradictions. I think the real point is this. You can't have a viable Zionist movement without Jews, because you cannot populate a Jewish state without a population of Jews who want to populate that Jewish state. And that didn't come about until the late 19th century, even the beginnings of it. So, I mean, people like Napoleon had all sorts of fantasies about this, you know, how we, one day there'll be a Jewish state, but they couldn't do anything about it until the material conditions actually matured for it. I think it was just religious fantasy myself, you know. Not just Napoleon, but also Lord Palmerston, I think, had some ideas about this, but they were not practical in those days until the Zionist movement itself was founded by Theodor Herzl and his confederates, you know. And that became a material factor after a certain point. And it was a part of the Jewish bourgeoisie that under the impact of a renewed beginnings of persecution in the late 19th century, or at least the you know, anti-Semitism, the relation, the racial version of anti-Semitism founded by people like Wilhelm Marr, right? Their response to it was to do the opposite, was to say, well, okay, we need our own state, you know. And it would be an imperialist state because this is part of what became the imperialist bourgeoisie. The other question is this, that so I think it was capitalism always imperialist. I don't think it was. I think that capitalism was always linked with colonialism, right? The colonialism was an inherent part of the creation of Western capitalism. Britain was a slaving, you know, Britain was involved in the slave trade. So was the United States, was in part founded on the slave trade. And that was a supplementary contradiction that had to be ironed out in the Civil War, you know, much later, you know. But, yeah, indeed. The religious aspect that Susan mentioned, yes, it's true, but it's a fantasy, I think. But you know, capitalism.
With respect, given the millennium.
Yeah, imperialism.
You know,
imperialism is not simply a matter of yeah, slavery was used as other forms of crude plunder were used for primitive accumulation. But once advanced capitalist countries became into existence and started to fight each other for world domination, that really started, I think, in the late 19th century around Africa. And actually at the just at the turn of the century, there was very, very close to a war between Britain and France in Sudan. An incident at Fashoda, where there was a clash between British and French troops in Africa. It never happened, but it could have done. You know, there could have been a world war at the turn of the century. You know, it was delayed for around 15 years, and it turned out to be between Britain and Germany, Britain on one hand and France, and Germany on the other, and Austria, etc. But it was basically around the growth of major capitalist powers based on monopoly that fought each other for domination of the colonial war. That didn't, the colonial world, or the would-be colonial world. That didn't really happen until the end of the later part of the 19th century, the beginning of the 20th. I'll leave it there, but John wants to speak. Yeah.
Yeah, just, a little bit off topic, but, this thing, the support for Israel's support for Argentina in 1982, Falklands War. I mean, what can anyone answer me what that was all about and how much they did support Argentina in 82?
Interesting question. I mean, my understanding is that they also supported, they also were notorious in funding Salvadoran death squads and things like that in the 80s as well. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another intervention. About
supporting far right groups alongside the CIA. But you're right, John, they did. And it, and Thatcher worked very hard to keep it quiet.
Oh.
But that's why they were so upset with, what is it? Is it? It's not Excalibur. What was the name of the ship that got blown up?
It's the Galahad, wasn't it? Was it?
No,
Belgrano.
The one that began with an E. But it's. I didn't think it was Excalibur. It's got some stupid name. But yeah, it got blown up by a missile because, what was his name? Simon. Somebody, the guy who got very
badly burned. The guy who got very badly burned, yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah, yeah. And he was complaining about where they got the missiles from and who was helping them with the, you know, the satellites and the targeting.
Was that the Belgrano?
Belgrano.
No, the Argentinian.
They sank. Yes.
It was the Antelope, wasn't it?
Mm.
The Antelope, sure. That went up, there was a great big ball of fire. Whoosh.
Yeah,
I think that might be the one.
I mean, just that the I didn't know, I saw recently that, and I'd have to double check it, but I just realised recently that the Americans cost British lives in the Falklands, in the sense that what happened was Britain wanted to attack Argentina's mainland, the planes, where the planes were flying from. And the US put a stop to that. They said there's going to be no attacks on Argentina's mainland. And therefore the planes were still able to come and bomb the British fleet. I think that's right. But I'd have to double check that.
I'm just putting it in the chat for you, John. And a link.
Mm-hmm. Right. Anybody else want to speak? I would encourage anybody who wants to speak to speak.
Yeah. I mean, I think this isn't this part of the whole Israel as the, you know, existentially supported state, is we look at Zionism as if it's, you know, a all on its own. Whereas in actual fact, it's just another extremist cult that has been nurtured since the 1940s. In order to ensure US, you know, global dominance and hegemony, and has been successful in hiding the fact that it's also supporting, you know, right-wing extremist, as I said, right-wing extremist groups all over the world, you know. And, you know, if you scratch a color revolution or a regime change, then usually you'll find the CIA or somebody there, but nearly always MI6 will be laying the groundwork and, you know, fending off the media investigations and making sure that it all looks hunky dory and somehow free and democratic when it's just a load of crap. No?
Marie wants to speak, I think. Yeah.
I'd like to make a comment. Sorry, I'm not going to follow on from what you said, Susan.
No, that's fine.
I agree with what you said. It seems to me the question of ceasefire. It in the beginning, of course, I accepted it. I thought, you know, it was a way for people to express their indignation at the killing. But at the same time, it is very ambiguous. And now you've got a whole layer of people in the Labour Party that used to oppose this one. What's all that noise? There's a noise somewhere.
I'm not sure what the noise is.
No, this is not here. Okay, so, right, just to finish this thinking, there is something very incomplete and which disturbs me in the insistence for ceasefire, which in fact can mean also that Hamas should just accept, like this Cameron was saying. Yeah, why, if Hamas doesn't want to be killed, he only has to surrender the hostages, and then we have a ceasefire. I think this is not good enough, and a lot of opportunists in the Labour Party are using it.
Mm-hmm. Well, just on that, I think that's Hamas themselves are demanding a ceasefire and exchange of hostages. You know, that's the key question, exchange. You know, Hamas are quite prepared to give up the hostages as long as the Israelis give up, their hostages. You know, the enormous number of prisoners they're just arbitrarily interned and torturing and abusing and even murdering in some cases. You know, I think that you're right, though, that the question of a permanent ceasefire is, there is an equivocation in the Labour Party, and some of the verbiage is actually very deceptive, because behind it is this idea that Hamas should just surrender. And I don't think that Hamas did not endorse the demand for them to surrender. The agreement that they signed with Egypt and with Qatar did not call for Hamas to surrender. It called for an exchange of hostages, an exchange of prisoners, whatever, you know, which is part of Hamas's objectives. And if Israel is forced to concede that, which I think it probably will be eventually, but I'm not sure when, you know, I mean, if they, you know, this Rafah affair is the last thing they can really do, you know, I mean, it's terrible, but after that, what? They are stumped, aren't they? You know. Because they haven't defeated Hamas, even in the north, where they've killed lots of people and forced people to flee. Hamas is still militarily operative. And that's why they're trying it again, because they haven't won. You know, and you think they could win, but they haven't. And that's the peculiarity. Yeah, but I do agree that there is a lot of hypocrisy on this question. The Labour Party initially opposed the ceasefire, but because there's been such mass pressure on the, to demand one, that they're now deceptively talking about a ceasefire. But what they actually mean is a Hamas defeat. You know, that is true. You know, it has to be sorted out. It has to be said, you know, that these people are liars, or at least the supporters of Starmer and David Lammy and that, who are talking about this, are liars. And they're trying to evade the question, which they always were. You know, once they started to have to shift their position, they'd been evasive, you know, and tried to, you know, blend in, but at the same time, equivocate, you know. Susan, sorry.
One thing I found really interesting this morning was that, the settlers in northern Israel, sort of southern Lebanon, are asking to set up a second Israeli state. They want to be responsible for their own protection, and they're thoroughly fed up. And I'm just listening to it and going, two Israeli states and no Palestine is twice as bad. But it, you know, it's the way in which it's anything to take it off the fact that, as you say, there are 10,000 Palestinian prisoners who were rounded up after October the 7th to ensure that they had even more hostages. And every time they freed any, they took 10 times more. And nobody is talking about Lavender and their AI program of wiping out entire bloodlines, entire families. That brings us back to the highly unpleasant, shall we say, I'm going to upset people, but it is that whole neo-Nazi ideal of this is about an ethno-bloodline. Mm. It's not a religious thing. You can convert to Judaism with difficulty, I admit, but you can't change your bloodline. And that is something that the genocide is it designed to do. It's about preventing anyone having, not only is there no buildings to come back to in Gaza, but that there are no people to come back as right of return. You know, if they went to the Sinai Desert, they would be genocided by dehydration or they'd be bombed. It's what happens in every refugee camp that the Palestinians retreat to. And we have not publicized that.
Oh.
Yeah, we could go into bourgeoisie politics. One of the factors that has influenced the changes or the apparent change in Labour position with regard to ceasefire is the knowledge by some of the shadow front bankers that some of them have got potential socialist candidates standing against them at the next election whenever that comes.
Mm.
And that is actually happening. And as we've seen, and even on a local council level, I think Oldham was one place where five new councillors that have been elected, Labour lost to five independents that stood. I think there were more independent, but five of them stood on a pro-Palestine ticket. So that was one significant development. And also in the West Midlands mayoral contest, Labour held on to it, but it lost a lot of votes to an independent pro-Palestine candidate. So, you know, so that's why there was a slight shift in Labour position. I mean, it's window dressing in practice, but it just shows what can happen, even in electoral politics, when people can find a way to organise on the ground, and that's what we're now seeing.
Yeah. Well, just on that, I mean, I think yeah, it's very clear that there have been some serious setbacks for the Labour Party at the hands of people from outside. You know, the Galloway victory in Rochdale was the beginning, but there have been others. I mean, it's Oldham and Blackburn, and now actually, Craig Murray is pretty confident that he could win us parliamentary seats as a result of what's happened in Blackburn, you know. And he may well be right, you know, against the Labour Party. And I think there will be others as well. I don't know how many there will be, but I think there will be a significant shift in the general election that should lead to the result of the beginnings of an oppositional body in Parliament of some sort, you know, the left-wing opposition to the Labour Party. And there are splinter, you know, there are other people. Claudia Webb, I believe, is in negotiation with the Workers' Party. She was, you know, thrown out of Labour because of a fraudulent racist prosecution, which has now been exposed, right? it'd be, you know, that would be quite a feather in the cap of Galloway's party if that's the case, you know. I do think there's, you know, there is potential. I mean, there are other things going on. There is the Akissa, of course, and various independent candidacies in Liverpool, in Enfield, in, you know, around the country, really. There are possible. And, of course, Galloway's party is planning to stand in every seat it can. You know, whether it will stand in every seat, I suspect not in the end. But I suspect...
No, they've already made a commitment not to stand against either Jeremy Corbyn or Diane Abbott or any genuine socialist.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. But I think they'll stand in many seats, including my own, actually. And if there's a half decent candidate, I'll go and work for them, you know. As long as it's not some lunatic twat who Galloway does associate with sometimes. But
I noticed Garland Nixon interviewed Jill Stein, who was talking about her chances of getting on the ballot. and being a genuine opposition, because she is pro-Palestine.
Yeah. Unlike some other Greens, yes, I agree.
Yeah.
It's interesting, anyway. It's a possibility. Yeah. Paul again, sorry.
On the case of American politics, I mean, Keith mentioned Jill Stein. I did support her at one point, but the person that I've been following at the moment is actually Cornel West, who actually left the American Green Party and he's now got an independent platform. I think there were some problems in the US Greens. They're probably a bit bourgeoisie, like our Green Party in England and Wales. I find a lot of Cornel West platform quite significant. I don't think he'd get very far for that reason, but nevertheless, I am supporting him for the US election, and I hope he surprises us and gets further than what some of us expect. Thanks.
Yes. Anybody else want to speak on this? If there are no more, should we stop the recording and we can go on and discuss anything else anybody wants to discuss? Is that all right?
Yeah.
So I'll just basically have a two-point agenda, which is the forum itself and any other business. But I'll stop the recording for that, yeah? Okay, thank you. Cheers.